Jack Clark, please.
Charlie, you wouldn't sign a proclamation for that, would you?
I wouldn't sign a proclamation.
I say Jack Clark because I've come to know him. It's Dr. John Clark, and he's one of the, well, I won't state his credentials.
Dr. Clark, will you be sworn in, please? Must also ask you the same five standard questions, sir. Are you appearing here today and testifying under oath voluntarily?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Have you been paid by anyone for your testimony other than expenses for coming to Clearwater?
No.
Do you have a lawsuit against the Church of Scientology?
No.
Do they have a lawsuit against you?
Yes.
They do. Has anyone suggested to you that you should state anything but the truth, or has anyone suggested that you change your testimony for any reason?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Fleming, I'll present your witness, or Dr. Clark, how do you would like to proceed?
The purpose of this testimony is basically in the line of expert testimony, because there are mental health conditions involved in this city. There are mental health permission issues that have been presented before the board. In addition to that, there's a level of harassment which goes to some of the policy considerations I've mentioned earlier that Dr. Clark has been subjected to, but his basic testimony is of an expert nature with regard to some of these mental health
issues. Since you are an expert witness, state your qualifications, please, sir.
My name is John G. Clark, Jr., M.D. I have been an M.D. from 1953 at the time I graduated from Harvard Medical School. I have been trained in psychiatry in the Boston area at the Massachusetts General Hospital and the McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, also a part of the Massachusetts General Hospital. I have worked on the staff, on the staffs of these two hospitals, as well as another organization in the same area. I am now in private practice since 1973. My work has been very, very wide, mostly clinical, and having to do with people from adolescence on up, as well as community work in various places around the Boston area. My interest in Scientology came along at the same time with my interest in rapid conversions and the processes that led up to those conversions. This is not a well-known area in the psychiatric world.
Explain rapid conversions.
Rapid conversion tends to be a massive change of personality, of belief systems over a very short time, brought about by usually deceptive practices of the people who want to get these people. There are also very many other kinds of conversions which are expected, useful, sometimes related to real illness such as temporal lobe epilepsy, for instance. It's a very, very interesting area. I showed my interest 2 years after I began to do some studying. I studied as a result of being asked by a fellow physician for help. He had problems with his son who was a disturbed young man who had gotten himself involved in the Hare Krishna cult. 2 years later, approximately, I had begun to believe these astounding things which I was hearing about and actually seeing. It was very hard to believe. In other words, I did not go into this study clearly knowing what I wanted to hear. I then spoke, gave testimony to the special group, the special committee, the Senate of the Vermont Legislature in 1976. From that time, the fat was in the fire, because I did mention among a few other people, the Church of Scientology. I found out much later, just very recently, that they had been worried about me before I even got to that particular place to speak my words. From that point on, there has been an unremitting kind of how can I say, harassment, whatever they wished to try to do to me to get me out of this business. They seem to be very, very frightened of somebody as legitimate as a Harvard professor who could possibly talk a negative way about their behavior. I might say in this regard, I am not interested in religion itself. I'm interested in the behavior of groups and the relationship of those behaviors to what I would consider to be harmful results, and especially through the process of conversion. And I will not have time to give you the entire view of that. I would like to first show you how hard it is for any kind of a professional to look into this area. This is very much like an anthropologist who decides he must go up the Sepik River in New Guinea in order to look into the mating processes of the some of the natives up there who are still eating one another to a degree. Now, I don't mean to put down their culture. Their cultures in some ways are just as valid as ours. But the people who come in from the outside are not necessarily going to be treated all that well. And it was my interest in looking into the cultures of these groups to find out what had happened to the individuals who had been taken into them, and why have they changed so much, and why have they become so mean. Now, I can give you a brief listing of what has happened. In my writing, I have put down some of the attacks on me. In 77, I got my first letter from them telling me that I had said the wrong things in the Vermont legislative hearing, and I better stop it. I got a series of calls, all of which I pretty much ignored. They also, that's quite simultaneously, wrote a whole series of letters to the deans at Harvard Medical School and the head of the Massachusetts General Hospital. In 78, three of my patients were investigated enough so that their places of work and their places of living were known to the Scientologists, who then called them and asked them about my behavior in treating them. To a doctor, that is extremely bad business, just terrible. Shortly after that, in about 78, I was called a communist because of the their interest in my daughter and my having gone to Russia to visit. And they put that into some very interesting fiction, which they had put together from all of their investigations of my neighbors, from my neighbors and friends, and which they then presented to the legislative committee that was beginning to look into some matters about the cults. They also tried twice to keep me out of England by sending a very strong protests to the proper authorities in England. Of course, they didn't matter somehow or other. In 1979, I and a number of others were picketed by the Scientologists dressed as Nazis twice, once in Pennsylvania at a meeting we were having and talking about cults, and one at the NIMH, where we were having the only meeting on the cults that the government has been able to put together so far. In 1978, they lodged a complaint to the Board of Registration of Medicine, and the this is the board that gives us our right to practice medicine in Massachusetts. This had to do with my behavior in court on a case that had to do with the original family that brought me into this whole business in the first place. The that particular problem with board registration stretched on for a very long time. By 1979, they were in Montreal passing out flyers at the place where I was giving my lectures at McGill. This time they were calling me a Nazi. 1980, they were sending an article to all kinds of people very high up in my profession, purporting to be something rather favorable to me, except that it was about ECT, electric shock treatment, and it had some material in it that seemed to be direct quotes from me saying that deprogramming could be brought about by the use of electric shock treatment. Fortunately, I have friends who called me up and say, what's this all about? But I'm still quite sure that some people think that I am advocating ECT. They began to blow hard in various ways toward me in their magazine or their Freedom paper, and we have one copy of the most recent one, 78-81, calling me a Nazi and one of the leaders of the ARM, as they call it in their own internal records, and that's the anti-religious movement. Several people approached my professor, one, a college student who was looking for information and just happened to mention me in some way that was really quite derogatory. A fake patient tried to get into my office and talk to me. Somebody on one of the television shows from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights talked about my use of drugs and ECT and my terrible attitude toward these people. Another, about 80, another student wanted to study deprogramming, and it was quite clear that when we checked up that that was certainly not what she was interested in. It goes on and on and on. In 1981, another complaint was lodged at the Board of Registration, and in this and a second one was also lodged, a third one now, lodged against me. Both of them very, very clearly, one from a Scientologist and the other one, again, purportedly from a Mooney. However, it had all the earmarks of the Scientology capacity to cause mischief. By the way, all of these complaints have been dismissed. The first one is dismissed with a little bit of nastiness on the part of the board, which could not understand what was going on. The last two, which recently came to me, are clear, clear releases from any obligation to them at all. This past year, from last July, there has been a firestorm of attack. There's almost something once or twice every week coming up. Because I have an answering service, they can't do some of the things that they did to Paulette, but they did a few other interesting things, such as picketing the Mass General Hospital and passing out some very interesting leaflets offering a $25,000 reward, for instance, for information leading to my conviction. This was done at several hospitals around. They approached every newspaper and every TV outlet.
In one city government?
Yep.
They only offered $4,950 for hours, so.
Well, that's beginning to make me think bigger than I really thought I was. I was thinking, as I was listening to everybody here, that I was pretty small potatoes as far as what has gone on. These are all, it even goes on further. They also informed me, in the midst of all of this, with many, many details, of a kangaroo court, an ethics trial, last fall, and they had it, and they, I guess you would probably believe that they convicted me. But they offered me the possibility of some kind of release if I would just admit that I was wrong. And so it goes on and on and on, and it's obvious that this organization does not want to be criticized, and that the way of handling criticism is the ad hominem attack, which is what we've been talking about all along. It is very, very unlikely that they will really argue on the basis of the facts or of the allegations against them. They will simply try to do what they have done before, that is, to make life too painful for anybody to go on with this kind of attack, which they are launching on me. They consider me someone with some sort of animus against them, which, of course, they will try to prove in these various cases against me. And as a matter of fact, they make their own enemies, obsessively make their own enemies. They try very hard not to let anybody know that, but anybody who even begins to look into this and who speaks out at all is going to find that the enemy situation has once again arisen. I would like to then talk a little bit about what happens. You want to show that? All right. From a clinical view, I'm really not all that happy just to talk about my own, the depredations against me. I'm surviving them, and but I think they are somehow illustrative of the problem. And
we know what we're going to have to go through.
You might as well face up to it. You're becoming heroes, whether you like it or not. And, we'll talk about suggestions for their improvement maybe later. What happens, and in general, what happens to the people who go into Scientology? Why do they change so much? How does it happen? What is there about the human mind that most of us do not even want to know that does make it possible for one of our children who has been thoroughly healthy in every way to be caught up in one of these groups and suddenly, or over a few months, simply lost to the parents and to the community? The change in these people tends to be very, very large. The parents who have said to me that my two older kids got into drugs and sex and they led me a merry chase, but I knew that was just sort of added on and applied to them. On my younger daughter, who was the nice one, was behaving herself, went into the Divine Light mission, the change was integral. This is also true of the changes of people who go into the Church of Scientology. In fact, in some ways, the changes are even more complete. It's no wonder, for instance, that they tend not to like to have people in amongst them whose parents and family do not agree with their choice, if you want to call it a choice, their PTSs. And often they do not allow them to stay in. It's much easier to bring about these changes and have it not noted, or them not noted, if the parents don't either don't give a damn or sort of they sort of like the quiet, controlled people that have now stopped taking drugs and are very, very busy doing what they're supposed to do. But in fact, the human mind is capable of an enormous amount of change in a short time. It can, as I said, happen from natural forces. is quite commonly seen in a temporal lobe epilepsy. And sometimes I should also mention, just for your imaginations to work on, that the people with temporal lobe epilepsy are also characterized by their absolute need to write constantly, write. Turn up the poetry, and they just write in scriptomania. I'm not suggesting that anybody we have ever talked about today might have anything like that, but it's very clear that some of these people who also go through various kinds of conversions do have that those who go through these conversions naturally do have real changes in their brain structure. But you don't have to have that. You can be an ordinary kid who's just going through a bad time. And that's why the late adolescents are the best marketplace for the cults in general. The process is quite fairly simple to bring them in. First, get their attention, entice them into some place where they can then be bombarded by information in a closed system where all the information is controlled and where that seduction can be set up. Over a period of time, and it can be very short from minutes to weeks, the attention of the individual is very carefully narrowed, just narrowed. These various processes that are used in Scientology, for instance, are attention narrowing processes. That it requires that the individual should attend to only the task for a very, very long time. There is in this a great relationship to formal hypnosis. In fact, it's exactly the same, it's just done differently. And the object is to push the mind, the attention, into a narrower and narrower state until something kind of breaks. It's a system, the mind is a system that is highly flexible, but with any flexible system, there is a limit of elasticity. If you push it hard enough, you'll crack, snap, whatever you want to call it. Any one of us, under certain circumstances of very high pressure, might find ourselves cracking one way or another. Then, if the person who has brought about this cracking, this changing, this snapping, this trance state, can manage that state for a time, can manage it and keep it under control, in other words, the person's old mind has been taken down under this heavy pressure, a kind of an emergency, if they can keep it under control long enough, the individual must then identify with those people who are managing the whole system. They identify with everything. They begin to take in the information, the rules, the language, everything. It's like falling in love. It's the same process, except that it's managed differently. That's why this is so mundane in one respect. There's nothing about this that is really, really spooky. But if it is managed in just the right way, by very intense processes, and by people who signal their intent to control, which again applies to this matter today, the individual, as I said, becomes almost as all those other people. The only way to survive, for the mind to survive, is to become as much like the persons who have begun to hold you as hostage as possible. There's been a lot written about the Stockholm effect in hostage taking, where the people who are with the hostage for a long time in a very ambiguous state, not knowing whether or not they're going to be killed or are tortured or something. These people sometimes fall in love with the person who has held them hostage. Again, we're back to the fact that most of this is normal, but it is manipulated. It must be remembered that in almost all, in fact, really in all those organizations which are most dangerous, nobody is told in advance what is going to happen. There is no argument about the virtues of the organization and its belief systems until after the change of the mind, the conversion. It's a snapping, it's whatever you want, a leap into another world. Now, this means that these people who have gone that far are now in a different state of mind, essentially a separate personality. This is a dual personality. The first personality is put on hold. Again, it sounds like science fiction, but it can be done. It can be replicated. It's been done in by hypnosis. And it has to be managed by more and more and more processes so that the whole thing just sort of gels and the people just can't get out. They cannot get out. But it's made easier for them to stay in if they are kept with their own people, so that they don't have a chance to sort of talk it out with people completely outside. And this is what happens. Now, in this state, these various kinds of cults become the most dangerous of all people. That is, they take on, as a mass, the we-they psychology. That is, we exist and we're real. They're all of you, you don't understand us. And because they're so focused and cannot remember any of the tenderness of their earlier times toward parents or friends or just others, they are extremely intolerant, extremely intolerant. They're at the edge of paranoia in their simplicity of thinking and are easily pushed, well, they're totally pushed around by their leaders. This means that within 2 weeks, individuals who have first met the Moonies have signed checks for $150,000 to go to the Moonies. You see, it isn't just the Church of Scientology that can get a lot of money out of people in a hurry. In these groups, almost every case, it's almost a real rule. The people who run them are living still. They're the living leaders, these charismatic individuals who have found out how to manipulate other people's minds are living. It's very hard for most cults to continue to go on. Probably 99.9% of them die within one generation for one reason, or for very good reasons, often because the children don't go along with it. They are in this state, the we-they state, entirely non-charitable. They do not see others as valid. They're not real. In the case of the Church of Scientology, those who have gone far enough through their processing do not believe that it is important to be a human being. They are something else, and those of us who are human beings have no regard for them. Our lives are of no importance whatsoever. It's something else. Perhaps you say that's getting into their religious beliefs, but sometimes you have to know something about the nature of belief in order to understand behavior, especially if it's as egregious as that which we are talking about today. Another factor in this is all too often the reason that individuals come out in a really terrible state or dead, and that is they reject all magic except their own. And now I'm saying that somewhat ironically. They think, for instance, that medicine is bad magic. And thus, and because they also reject the scientific view of knowledge, they are unable to understand the medical position on anything. Thus, too many of these groups, and again we're talking about Scientology in particular, are not at all capable of approaching doctors effectively, and they're often too late when they do. They have a few captured physicians working with them, and I say with no prejudice to the to them that many, many chiropractors seem to have been gotten in. It is necessary, in the case of all of these groups, that they isolate these people that they have just brought in, their proselytes, isolate them from their families, because their families remind them too much of the past, and they can sometimes break in to the mind control state. And one other little thing, I'll just mention the TRs and the bull baiting, which are seen as by me as matters of managing the focusing of the mind. There are many, many ways of doing that. I think that the particular ways that the Church of Scientology does this can be extraordinarily damaging over the long run and over the short run. These are exercises involving two people across a table with the E-meter in the middle, with the face of the E-meter to the auditor. And thus, certain kinds of processes, like questions, are asked over and over and over again in such a way that it is impossible for the individual to answer them really quite right, depending a little bit on what the auditor wants to get from these persons. This is also eye-to-eye contact with thus the individual who is being brought in must pay absolute attention to the auditor or will have to flunk and go back to the beginning of these rather painful processes. And by the time the individual gets through with this, the mind is already in trouble. By the time they go through the first auditing courses successfully, they are entirely under control of the auditor itself and will take almost any order from that person. One of the more heavy auditing processes that I have heard of is the one of sitting knee-to-knee for about 8 hours looking at one another and saying nothing and not blinking, or answering some absurd question over and over and over and over and over, perhaps sometimes with bull baiting, which means that they'll have to answer these questions correctly no matter what else is going on in the room, whether or not they're personal touches, some kind of laughing, some kind of nasty statements, sexual approaches. The person being auditing cannot even begin to show any movement on the E-meter or any in the face. They must be absolutely flat. In other words, that person must not respond emotionally to anything. This kind of treatment of the individual to cut out any response to, for instance, conscience or the outrageous processes that are going on simply empties them of this capacity to act really in a human way. Now, for a while, it feels fine. But often, these people have gone through an enormous amount of pain to get to the point where they think they're beginning to be happier. And in fact, very few of them are happy. They're just reaching for that which they have been promised, but never comes.